anything. Anything can strike 11-year-olds funny, and the two of them had laughed like fiends. Brian's eyes had looked up at him from the hospital bed, and through him, they were open and as empty as school classrooms in August. Feeling more than ever as if he were not moving, but being moved, David had walked into the magic circle of the machines. He observed the suction cups on Brian's chest and temples. He observed the wires coming out of the suction cups. He observed the oddly misshapen look of the helmet-sized bandage on the left side of Brian's head, as if the shape beneath it had been radically changed. David supposed it had been. When you hit the side of a brick house, something had to give. There was a tube in Brian's right arm and another coming out of his chest. The tubes went to bags of liquid hanging off poles. There was a plastic doodad in Brian's nose and a band on his wrist. David thought, those are the machines that are keeping him alive. And when they turn them off, when they pull out the needles. Disbelief filled him at the idea. Buds of wonder, which were only grief, rolled tight. He and Brian squirted each other at the water fountain outside their home room at school whenever they thought they could get away with it. They rode their bikes in the fabled Bear Street woods, pretending they were commandos. They swapped books and comics and baseball cards, and sometimes just sat on David's back porch, playing with Brian's Game Boy, or reading and drinking David's mom's lemonade. They slapped each other high fives and called each other bad boy. Sometimes, when it was just the two of them, they called each other fuckhead or dickweed. In the second grade, they'd pricked their fingers with pins and smooshed them together and sworn themselves blood brothers. In August of this year, they had made, with Mark Ross's help, a bottle cap Parthenon from a picture in a book. It turned out so well that Mark kept it in the downstairs hall and showed it to company. At the first of the year, the bottle cap Parthenon was slated to travel the block and a half to the Carver house. It was the Parthenon that David's mind had fixed upon most firmly as he stood by his comatose friend's bed. They had built it, him, Brian, Brian's dad, out in the Ross garage while the tape player endlessly recycled Rattle and Hum on the shelf behind them. A silly thing because it was just bottle caps. A cool thing because it looked like what it was supposed to look like. You could tell what it was. Also a cool thing because they had made it with their own hands. And soon Brian's hands would be picked up and scrubbed by an undertaker who would use a special brush and pay particular attention to the fingernails. No one would want to look at a corpse with dirty nails, David supposed. And after Bry's hands were clean and he was in the coffin his folks would pick out for him, the undertaker would lace his fingers together like they were a pair of sneakers. And that was how they'd stay, down in the ground, neatly folded, the way they had been supposed to fold their hands on their desks back in the second grade. No more bottle cap buildings for those hands. No more water fountain nozzles for those fingers, down into the dark with them. It was not terror this thought had called up in his mind and heart, but despair, as if the image of Brian's fingers laced together in his coffin proved that nothing was worth anything, that doing never once in the world stopped dying, that not even kids were exempted from the horror show that roared on and on behind the peppermint sitcom facade your parents believed in and wanted you to believe in. Neither Mr. nor Mrs. Ross spoke to him as he stood by the bed, meditating on these things in the shorthand of children. And their silence was all right with David. He liked them just fine, especially Mr. Ross, who had a sort of interesting crazy streak. But he hadn't come here to see them. They weren't the ones with the food tubes and breathing machinery that was going to be taken away after the grandparents got a chance to say goodbye. He had come to see Brian. David had taken his friend's hand. It was astoundingly cool and lax in his own, but still alive. You could feel the life in it, running like a motor. He squeezed it gently and whispered, "How you doing, bad boy?" No response but the sound of the machine that was doing Brian's breathing for him now that his brain had blown most of its fuses. This machine was at the head of the bed, and it was the biggest. It had a clear plastic tube mounted on one side of it. Inside the tube was something that looked like a white accordion. The sound this machine made was quiet. All the machines were quiet. But the accordion thing was unsettling just the same. It made a low, emphatic noise each time it went up. A gasping noise. It was as if part of Brian wasn't down too deep to feel pain, but that part had been taken out of his body and penned up in the plastic tube, where it was now being hurt even worse, where it was being pressed to death by the white accordion thing. And then there were the eyes. David felt his eyes drawn back to them again and again. Nobody had told him Brian's eyes would be open. Until just now, he hadn't known your eyes could be open when you were unconscious. Debbie Ross had told him not to be shocked, that Brian didn't look very nice. But she hadn't told him anything about that stuffed moose stare. Maybe that was all right, though. Maybe you could never be prepared about the really awful things, not at any age. One of Brian's eyes was bloodshot, with a huge black pupil that ate up all but the thinnest ring of brown. The other was clear, and the pupil appeared to be normal, but nothing else was normal, because there was no sign of his friend in those eyes, none. The boy who had cracked him up by saying, "Oh shit, the mummy's after us, let's all walk a little faster," wasn't here at all, unless he was in the plastic tube, at the mercy of the white accordion. David would look away, at the stitched fishhook cut, at the bandage, at the one waxy ear he could see below the bandage. And then his gaze would wander back to Brian's open, staring eyes with their mismatched pupils. It was the nothing that drew him, the absence, the goneness in those eyes. It was more than wrong. It was evil, a voice deep in his head whispered. It was like no voice he had ever heard in his thoughts before, a total stranger, and when Debbie Ross's hand dropped on his shoulder, he'd had to clamp his lips together against a scream. "The man who did it was drunk," she said in a husky, tear-clotted voice. Fresh tears were rolling down her cheeks. "He says he doesn't remember any of it. That he was in a blackout. And do you know the horrible thing, Davy? I believe him." "Deb," Mr. Ross began, but Brian's mom took no notice of him. "How could God let that man not remember hitting my son with his car?" Her voice had begun to rise. Ralph Carver had poked his head around the edge of the open door, startled, and a nurse rolling a cart up the hall stopped dead in her tracks. She looked into room 508 with a pair of big blue, oh goodness, eyes. "How could God be so merciful to someone who deserves to wake up screaming with memories of the blood coming out of my son's poor hurt head every night for the rest of his life?" Mr. Ross put his arm around her shoulders. Outside the door, Ralph Carver pulled his head back like a turtle withdrawing into its shell. David saw this and might have hated his dad a little for it. He couldn't remember for sure one way or the other. What he remembered was looking down at Brian's pale, still face with the misshapen bandage seeming to bear down on it, the waxy ear, the cut with its red lips drawn together in a smooch by the black thread, and the eyes. Most of all, what he remembered was the eyes. Brian's mother was right there, crying and screaming, and those eyes didn't change a bit. "But he is in there," David thought suddenly, and that thought, like so much that had happened to him since his mother had told him about Brian's accident, did not feel like something that was coming from him, but only something going through him, as if his mind and body had turned into some sort of pipe. He is in there. I know he is. Still in there, like someone caught in a landslide, or a cave-in. Debbie Ross's control had given way entirely. She was almost howling, shaking in her husband's grip, trying to pull free. Mr. Ross got her headed back toward the red chairs, but it looked like a job. The nurse hurried in and slipped an arm around her waist. "Mrs. Ross, sit down. You'll feel better if you do." "What sort of God lets a man forget killing a little boy?" Brian's mom had screamed. "The kind that wants that man to get loaded and do it again, that's who. A God who loves drunks and hates little boys." Brian, looking up with his absent eyes, harking to his mother's sermon with a waxy ear, not noticing, not here, but... "Yes," something whispered. "Yes, he is. He is. Somewhere." "Nurse, can you give my wife a shot?" Mr. Ross had asked. By then, he was having a hard time keeping her from leaping back across the room and grabbing David, her son, maybe both of them. Something in her head had broken free. It was something that had a lot to say. "I'll get Dr. Burgoyne. He's just up the hall." She hurried out. Brian's dad gave David a strained smile. There was sweat trickling down his cheeks and standing out on his forehead in a galaxy of fine dots. His eyes were red, and to David, he looked like he had already lost weight. David didn't think such a thing was possible, but that was how he had looked. Mr. Ross now had one arm around his wife's waist, and his other hand clamped on her shoulder. "You have to go now, David," Mr. Ross said. He was trying not to pant, and panting a little anyway. We're not doing so good." "But I didn't say goodbye to him," David wanted to say, and then realized it wasn't sweat trickling down Mr. Ross's cheeks, but tears. That got him moving. It wasn't until he got to the door and turned back and saw Mr. and Mrs. Ross had blurred into a whole crowd of parents that he realized he was shortly going to be crying himself. "May I come back, Mr. Ross?" he asked in a cracked, shivery voice he barely recognized. "Tomorrow, maybe?" Mrs. Ross had stopped struggling now. Mr. Ross's hands had ended up locked together just below her breasts, and her head was bent so her hair hung in her face. The way they looked made David think of the World Federation wrestling matches he and Bri had also sometimes watched, and how sometimes one guy would hug another guy like that. "Oh, shit, the mummy's after us," David thought, for no good reason at all. Mr. Ross was shaking his head. "I don't think so, Davy." "But, no, I don't think so. You see, the doctors say there's no chance at all for Brian to... His face began to change, as David had never seen an adult's face change. It seemed to be tearing itself apart from the inside. It was only later, out in the Bear Street woods, that he got a handle on it. Sort of. He'd been seeing what happened when someone who hadn't cried in a long time, years maybe, finally couldn't hold back any longer. This was what it was like when the dam burst. "Oh, my boy!" Mr. Ross screamed. "Oh, my boy!" He let go of his wife and fell back against the wall between the two red vinyl chairs. He stood there for a moment, kind of leaning, then folded at the knees. He slid down the wall until he was sitting, hands held out toward the bed, cheeks wet, snot hanging from his nostrils, hair sticking up in the back, shirt tail out, pants pulled up so you could see the tops of his socks. He sat there like that and wailed. His wife knelt by him and took him in her arms as best she could, and that was when the doctor came in with the nurse right behind him, and when David slipped out, crying hard but trying not to sob. They were in a hospital, after all, and some people were trying to get well. His father was as pale as his mother had been when she told him about Brian, and when he took David's hand, his skin was much colder than Brian's had been. "I'm sorry you had to see that," his father said as they waited for the world's slowest elevator. David had an idea it was all he could think of to say. On the ride home, Ralph Carver started to speak twice, then stopped. He turned on the radio, found an oldie station, then turned it down to ask David if he wanted an ice cream soda or anything. David shook his head, and his father turned the music up again, louder than ever. When they got home, David told his father he thought he'd shoot some baskets in the driveway. His father said that was fine, then hurried inside. As David stood behind the crack in the hot top that he used as a foul line, he heard his parents in the kitchen, their voices drifting out of the open window over the sink. She wanted to know what had happened, how David had taken it. "Well, there was a scene," his father said, as though Brian's coma and approaching death were part of some play. David tuned out. That sense of otherness had come on him again, that feeling of being small, a part instead of a whole, someone else's business. He suddenly felt very strongly that he wanted to go down to the Bear Street woods, down to the little clearing. A path, narrow, but you could ride bikes along it if you went single file, led into this clearing. It was here, up in the Viet Cong lookout, that the boys had tried one of Debbie Ross's cigarettes the year before and found it awful. Here that they had looked through their first copy of Penthouse. Brian had seen it lying on top of the dumpster behind the Easy Stop 24 down the hill from his house. Here that they had hung their feet down and had their long conversations and dreamed their dreams, mostly about how they were going to be the kings of West Wentworth Middle School when they were ninth graders. It was here, in the clearing you got to by way of the Ho Chi Minh Trail, that the boys had most enjoyed their friendship, and it was here that David suddenly felt he had to go. He had bounced the ball, with which he and Brian had played about a billion games of horse, one final time, bent his knees and shot. Swish. Nothing but net. When the ball returned to him, he tossed it into the grass. His folks were still in the kitchen, their voices still droning out the open window, but David didn't even think about poking his head in and telling them where he was going. They might have forbidden him. Taking his bike never occurred to him. He walked, head down, the bright blue, excused early pass still sticking out of his shirt pocket, although school was over for the day by then. The big yellow buses were rolling their homeward routes. Yelling flocks of little kids pounded past, waving their papers and lunchboxes. David took no notice. His mind was elsewhere. Later, Reverend Martin would tell him about the still small voice of God, and David would feel a tug of recognition, but it hadn't seemed like a voice then, or a thought, or even an intuition. The idea his mind kept returning to was how, when you were thirsty, your whole body cried for water, and how you would eventually lie down and drink from a mud puddle if that was all you could get. He came to Bear Street, then to the Ho Chi Minh Trail. He walked slowly down it, his head still lowered, so that he looked like a scholar with his mind on some immense problem. The Ho Chi Minh hadn't been his and Brian's exclusive property. Lots of kids ordinarily used it on their way to and from school. But no one had been on it that warm fall afternoon. It seemed to have been cleared especially for him. Halfway to the clearing, he spotted a Three Musketeers candy bar wrapper and picked it up. It was the only kind of candy bar Brian would eat. He called them Three Muskies, and David had no doubt that Brian had dropped this one beside the path a day or two before the accident. Not that Brian was ordinarily a litterbug sort of guy. He'd stuff the wrapper in his pocket under ordinary circumstances, but but maybe something made him drop it. Something that knew I'd come along after that car hit him and threw him and broke his head on the bricks. Something that knew I'd find it and remember him. He told himself that was crazy, absolutely nutzoid, but maybe the nuttiest thing of all was that he didn't really think it was. Perhaps it would sound nutty if spoken aloud, but inside his head it seemed perfectly logical. With no thought of what he was doing, David stuck the red and silver wrapper into his mouth and sucked the little bits of sweet chocolate off the inside. He did this with his eyes closed and fresh tears squeezing out from under the lids. When the chocolate was all gone and there was nothing left but the taste of wet paper, he spat the wrapper out and went on his way. At the east edge of the clearing was an oak with two thick branches spreading out in a V about 20 feet up. The boys hadn't quite dared go the whole hog and build a treehouse in this beckoning fork. Someone might notice and make them tear it down again. But they had brought boards, hammers, and nails down here one summer day a year ago and made a platform that still remained. David and Brian knew that the high school kids sometimes used it. They had found cigarette butts and beer cans on the weather-darkened old boards from time to time, and once a pair of pantyhose. But never until after dark, it seemed, and the idea of big kids using something they had made was actually sort of flattering. Also, the first handholds you had to grab in order to make the climb were high enough to discourage the little kids. David went up, cheeks wet, eyes swollen, still tasting chocolate and wet paper in his mouth, still hearing the gasp of the accordion thing in his ears. He felt he would find some other sign of Brian on the platform, like the Three Muskies wrapper on the path, but there was nothing. Just the sign nailed to the tree, the one that said, Viet Cong Lookout, which they had put up a couple of weeks after completing the platform. The inspiration for that, and for the name they'd given the path, was some old movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger in it. David didn't remember the name. He kept expecting to come up here someday and find that the big kids had pulled the sign down or spray-painted something like, Suck My Dick, on it. But none ever had. He guessed they must like it, too. A breeze soughed through the trees, cooling his hot skin. Any other day and Brian would have been sharing that breeze with him. They would have been dangling their feet, talking, laughing. David started to cry again. Why am I here? No answer. Why did I come? Did something make me come? No answer. If anyone's there, please answer. No answer for a long time. And then one did come, and he didn't think he was just talking to himself inside his own head, then fooling himself about what he was doing in order to gain a little comfort. As when he had stood over Brian, the thought which came seemed in no way his own. Yes, this voice had said, I'm here. Who are you? Who I am, the voice said, and then fell silent, as if that actually explained something. David crossed his legs, sitting tailor fashion in the middle of the platform, and closed his eyes. He cupped his knees in his palms and opened his mind as best he could. He had no idea what else to do. In this fashion he waited for an unknown length of time, hearing the distant voices of the home-going children, aware of shifting red and black shapes on the insides of his eyelids as the breeze moved the branches above him and dapples of sunlight slipped back and forth on his face. Tell me what you want, he asked the voice. No answer. The voice didn't seem to want anything. Tell me what to do, then. No answer from the voice. Distant, distant, he heard the sound of the firehouse whistle over on Columbus Broad. It was 5 o'clock. He had been sitting up on the platform with his eyes closed for at least an hour, probably more like 2. His mom and dad would have noticed he was no longer in the driveway, would have seen the ball lying in the grass, would be worried. He loved them and didn't want to worry them, On some level, he understood that Brian's impending death had struck at them as hard as it had struck at him. But he couldn't go home yet, because he wasn't done yet. "Do you want me to pray?" he asked the voice. "I'll try if you want me to, but I don't know how. We don't go to church, and..." The voice overrode his, not angry, not amused, not impatient, not anything he could read. "You're praying already," it said. "What should I pray for?" "Oh, shit, the mummy's after us," the voice said. "Let's all walk a little faster." "I don't know what that means."
"Yes, you do."
"No, I don't."
"Yes, I do," he said, almost moaned. "Yes, I do. It means ask for what none of them dare to ask for. Pray for what none of them dare to pray for. Is that it?"
No answer from the voice.
David opened his eyes, and the afternoon bombed him with late light, the red-gold glow of November. His legs were numb from the knees down, and he felt as if he had just awakened from a deep sleep. The day's simple, unzipped loveliness stunned him, and for a moment he was very aware of himself as a part of something whole, a cell on the living skin of the world. He lifted his hands from his knees, turned them over, and held them out.
"Make him better," he said. "God, make him better. If you do, I'll do something for you. I'll listen for what you want, and then I'll do it. I promise."
He didn't close his eyes, but listened carefully, waiting to see if the voice had anything more to say. At first, it seemed it did not. He lowered his hands, started to stand up, then winced at the burst of pins and needles that went whooshing up his legs from the balls of his feet. He even laughed a little. He grabbed a branch to steady himself, and as he was doing this, the voice did speak again. David listened, head cocked, still holding the branch, still feeling his muscles tingle crazily as the blood worked its way back into them. Then he nodded. They had put 3 nails into the trunk of the tree to hold the Viet Cong lookout sign. The wood had shrunk and warped since then, and the rusty heads of the nails stuck out. David took the blue pass with "Excused Early" printed on it from his shirt pocket and poked it onto one of the nail heads. That done, he marched in place until the tingling in his legs began to subside, and he trusted himself to climb back down the tree. He went home. He hadn't even gotten to the driveway before his parents were out the kitchen door. Ellen Carver stood on the stoop, hand raised to her forehead to shade her eyes, while Ralph almost ran down the sidewalk to meet him and grab him by the shoulders.
"Where were you? Where in the hell were you, David?"
"I went for a walk, into the Bear Street woods. I was thinking about Brian."
"Well, you scared the devil out of us," his mom said.
Kirsten joined her on the stoop. She was eating a bowl of Jell-O and had her favorite doll, Melissa's sweetheart, tucked under her arm.
"Even Kirsty was worried, weren't you?"
"Nope," Pye said, and went on eating her Jell-O.
"Are you all right?" his father had asked.
"Yes."
"Are you sure?"
"Yes." He went into the house, yanking on one of Pye's braids as he went past her. Pye wrinkled her nose at him, then smiled.
"Supper's almost ready. Go wash up," Ellen said.
The telephone started to ring. She went to answer it, then called sharply to David as he headed for the downstairs bathroom to wash his hands, which had been pretty dirty, sticky, sappy, tree-climbing dirty. He turned and saw his mom holding out the telephone in one fist while she twisted the other restlessly in her apron. She tried to talk, but at first no sound came out when her lips moved. She swallowed and tried again.
"It's Debbie Ross, for you. She's crying. I think it must be over. For God's sake, be kind to her."
David crossed the room and took the phone. That feeling of otherness had swept over him again. He had been sure his mom was at least half right. Something was over.
Hello, he said. Mrs. Ross? She was crying so hard that at first she couldn't talk. She tried, but what came through her sobs was just wah, wah, wah. From a little distance he heard Mr. Ross say, "Let me do it," and Mrs. Ross said, "No, I'm okay." There was a mighty honk in David's ear. It sounded like a hungry goose. And then she said, "Brian's awake." "Is he?" David said. What she had just said made him feel happier than he had ever been in his life, and yet it had not surprised him at all. "Is he dead?" Ellen was mouthing at him. One hand was still plunged deep into her apron, twisting and turning. "No," David said, putting his hand over the mouthpiece to talk to his mother and father. It was all right. He could do that. Debbie Ross was sobbing again. He thought she'd do that every time she told anyone, at least for a while. She wouldn't be able to help it, because her heart had given him up. "Is he dead?" Ellen mouthed again. "No," he told her, a little irritated. It was like she was deaf. "Not dead, alive. She says he's awake." His mother and father gaped like fish in an aquarium. Pi went past them, still eating jello, her face turned down to the face of her doll, which was sticking stiffly out from the crook of her arm. "Told you this would happen," she said to Melissa's sweetheart, in a forbidding, "this closes the discussion" tone of voice. "Didn't I say so?" "Awake," David's mother had said in a stunned, musing voice. "Alive." "David, are you there?" Mrs. Ross asked. "Yes," he said, "right here." "About 20 minutes after you left, the EEG monitor started to show waves. I saw them first. Mark was down in the caf getting sodas, and I went to the nurse's station. They didn't believe me." She laughed through her tears. "Well, of course, who would? And when I finally got someone to come look, they called maintenance instead of a doctor. That's how sure they were that it couldn't be happening. They actually replaced the monitor. Isn't that the most amazing thing you ever heard?" "Yes," David said. "Wild." Both parents were mouthing at him now, and his dad was also making big hand gestures. To David, he looked like an insane asylum inmate who thought he was a game show host. That made him want to laugh. He didn't want to do that while he was on the phone. Mrs. Ross wouldn't understand, so he turned and faced the wall. It wasn't until they saw the same high waves on the new monitor, only even stronger, that one of the nurses called Dr. Wasluski. He's the neurologist. Before he got here, Brian opened his eyes and looked around at us. He asked me if I'd fed the goldfish today. I said yes, the goldfish were fine. I didn't cry or anything. I was too stunned to cry. Then he said his head ached and closed his eyes again. When Dr. Wasluski came in, Brian looked like he was still in the coma, and I saw him give the nurse a look like, "Why do you bother me with this, you know?" "Sure," David said. But when the doctor clapped his hands beside Brian's ear, he opened his eyes again right away. "You should have seen that old Pollock's face, Davy." She laughed, the cracked, cackling laugh of a madwoman. Then Brian said he was thirsty and asked if he could have a drink of water. She broke down entirely then, her sobs so loud in his ear that they almost hurt. Then they faded, and Bri's dad said, "David, you still there?" He sounded none too steady himself, but he wasn't outright bawling, which was a relief. "Sure." Brian doesn't remember the accident. Doesn't remember anything after doing his homework in his room the night before it happened, but he remembers his name and his address and our names. He knows who the president is, and he can do simple math problems. Dr. Wasluski says he's heard of cases like this, but never actually seen one. He called it a clinical miracle. I don't know if that actually means anything, or if it's just something he's always wanted to say, and I don't care. I just want to thank you, David. So does Debbie, from the bottom of our hearts. "Me?" David asked. A hand was tugging his shoulder, trying to get him to turn around. He resisted it.
What are you thanking me for?
For bringing Brian back to us. You were talking to him. The waves started showing up just after you left. He heard you, Davy. He heard you and came back.
It wasn't me, David said.
He turned around. His folks were all but looming over him, their faces frantic with hope, amazement, confusion. His mother was crying. What a day for tears it had been. Only Pi, who usually bawled at least 6 hours out of every 24, seemed to have her shit together.
I know what I know, Mr. Ross said. I know what I know, David.
He had to talk to his parents before they stared at him so hard they set his shirt on fire. But before he did, there was one other thing he had to know.
What time did he wake up and ask about his goldfish? How long after you started seeing his brain waves?
Well, they changed the monitor. She told you that. And then, I don't know.
He trailed off for a moment, then said,
Yes, I do. I remember hearing the Columbus Broad fire whistle just before everything happened, so it must have been a few minutes past 5.
David had nodded, unsurprised. Right around the time the voice in his head had told him, You're praying already.
Can I come and see him tomorrow?
Mr. Rawson laughed then. David, you can come see him at midnight, if that's what you want.
Why not? Dr. Wasluski says we have to keep waking him up anyway and asking him stupid questions. I know what he's afraid of, that Brian will slip back into the coma, but I don't think that's going to happen. Do you?
Nope, David said. Bye, Mr. Ross.
He'd hung up the telephone then, and his parents all but pounced on him. How did it happen, they wanted to know. How did it happen, and what do they think you had to do with it?
David felt an urge then, an amazingly strong one, to cast his eyes down modestly and say,
Well, he woke up, that's really all I know, except, well.
He would pause with seeming reluctance, then add,
Mr. and Mrs. Ross think he might have heard my voice and responded to it, but you know how upset they've been.
That's all it would take to start a legend. Part of him knew it, and he wanted to do it. Part of him really, really wanted to do it.
It wasn't the strange inside-out voice that stopped him, but a thought of his own, one that was more intuited than articulated.
If you take the credit, it stops here.
What stops?
Everything that matters, the voice of intuition responded. Everything that matters.
David, come on, his father said, giving his shoulders a little shake. We're dying here.
Brian's awake, he said, choosing his words carefully. He can talk. He can remember. The brain guy says it's a miracle. Mr. and Mrs. Ross think I had something to do with it, that he heard me talking to him and came back, but nothing like that happened. I was holding his hand and he wasn't there. He was the most gone person I ever saw in my life. That's why I cried. Not because his folks were having a fit, but because he was gone. I don't know what happened, and I don't care. He's awake. That's all I care about.
That's all you need to care about, darling, his mother said, and gave him a brief, hard hug.
I'm hungry, he said. What's for supper?
3.
Now he hung in the black, blind but not deaf, listening for the voice, the one Reverend Jean Martin called the still, small voice of God. Reverend Martin had listened carefully to David's story not once but many times over the last 7 months, and he seemed especially pleased by David's recounting of how he had felt during the conversation with his parents after he had finished talking with Mr. Ross.
You were completely correct, Reverend Martin had said. It wasn't another voice you heard at the end. Especially not the voice of God, except in the sense that God always speaks to us through our consciences. Secular people, David, believe that the conscience is only a kind of censor, a place where social sanctions are stored. But in fact, It is itself a kind of outsider, often guiding us to good solutions even in situations far beyond our understanding. Do you follow me?
I think so.
You didn't know why it was wrong to take the credit for your friend's recovery, but you didn't need to. Satan tempted you as he tempted Moses, but in this case, you did what Moses didn't or couldn't. First understood, then withstood. What about Moses? What did he do?
Reverend Martin had told him the story of how, when the Israelites he'd led out of Egypt were thirsty, Moses had struck a stone with Aaron's staff and brought water gushing out of it. And when the Israelites asked to whom their thanks should be directed, Moses said they could thank him. Reverend Martin sipped from a teacup with "happy, joyous, and free" printed on the side as he told this story, but what was in the cup didn't exactly smell like tea to David. It smelled more like the whiskey his dad sometimes drank while watching the late news.
Just one little misstep in a long, hard-working life in the service of the Lord, Reverend Martin said cheerfully, but God kept him out of the promised land for it. Joshua led him across the river. Nasty, ungrateful bunch that they were. This conversation had taken place on a Sunday afternoon in June. By then, the two of them had known each other for quite a while and grown comfortable with each other. David had fallen into the habit of going to church in the morning, then walking over to the Methodist parsonage on Sunday afternoon and talking with Reverend Martin for an hour or so in his study. David looked forward to these meetings, and Jean Martin did too. He was immensely taken with the child, who seemed at one moment an ordinary boy and at the next someone much older than his years. And there was something else. He believed that David Carver had been touched by God, and that God's touch might not yet have departed. He was fascinated with the story of Brian Ross, and by how what had happened to Brian had caused David, a perfect late 20th century religious illiterate, to seek answers, to seek God. He told his wife that David was the only honest convert he had ever seen, and that what had happened to David's friend was the only modern miracle he'd ever heard of that he could actually believe in. Brian had turned out fine and dandy, except for a slight limp, and the doctor said even that might be gone in a year or so. Marvelous, Stella Martin replied. That will be a comfort to me and the baby if your young friend says the wrong thing about his religious instruction and you wind up in court, facing child abuse charges. You have to be careful, Jean, and you're crazy to be drinking around him.
I'm not drinking around him, Reverend Martin had replied, suddenly finding something interesting to look at out the window. At last he returned his eyes to his wife. As to the other, the Lord is my shepherd. He went on seeing David on Sunday afternoons. He was not quite 30 himself in discovering for the first time the pleasures of writing on a perfectly blank slate. He didn't quit mixing Seagram's with his tea, a Sunday afternoon tradition of long standing, but he left the study door open whenever he and David were together. The TV was always on during their conversations, always punched to mute and tuned to the various Sunday afternoon athletic contests. Soundless football when David first came to Reverend Martin, then soundless basketball, then soundless baseball. It was during a soundless baseball game between the Indians and the A's that David sat mulling over the story of Moses and the water from the rock. After a while, he looked up from the TV screen and said, "God isn't very forgiving, is he?"
"Yes, indeed he is," Reverend Martin said, sounding a little surprised. "He has to be, because he is so demanding."
"But he's cruel, too, isn't he?"
Jean Martin hadn't hesitated.
"Yes," he said, "God is cruel. I have popcorn, David. Would you like me to make some?"
Now he floated in the black, listening for Reverend Martin's cruel God, the one who had refused Moses entry into Canaan because Moses had one single time claimed God's work as his own, the one who had used him in some fashion to save Brian Ross, the one who had then killed his sweet little sister and put the rest of them in the hands of a giant lunatic who had the empty eyes of a coma patient.
There were other voices in the dark place where he went when he prayed. He heard them frequently while he was there. Usually distant, like the dim voices you sometimes heard in the background when you made a long-distance call. Sometimes more clearly. Today, one of them was very clear indeed. "If you want to pray, pray to me," it said. Why would you pray to a God who kills baby sisters? You'll never laugh at how funny she is again, or tickle her until she squeals, or pull her braids. She's dead, and you and your folks are in jail. When he comes back, the crazy cop, he'll probably kill all three of you, the others as well. This is what your God did, and really, what else would you expect from a God who kills baby sisters? He's as crazy as the cop when you get right down to cases. Yet you kneel before him. Come on, Davy, get a life. Get a grip. Pray to me. At least I'm not crazy. He wasn't rocked by this voice. Not very, anyway. He'd heard it before, perhaps first wrapped inside that strong impulse to give his folks the impression that he had called Brian back from the deep reaches of his coma. He heard it more clearly, more personally, during his daily prayers, and this had troubled him. But when he told Reverend Martin about how that voice would sometimes cut in, as if it were on a telephone extension, Reverend Martin had only laughed. Like God, Satan tends to speak to us most clearly in our prayers and meditations, he said. It's when we're most open, most in touch with our pneuma. Pneuma? What's that? Spirit. The part of you that yearns to fulfill its God-made potential and be eternal. The part that God and Satan are squabbling over even now. He had taught David a little mantra to use at such times, and he used it now. See in me, be in me, he thought, over and over again. He was waiting for the voice of the other to fade, but he also needed to get above the pain again. It kept coming back like cramps. Thinking about what had happened to Pi hurt so deep. And yes, he did resent God for letting the insane cop push her down those stairs. Resented, hell, hated. See in me, God. Be in me, God. See in me. Be in me. The voice of Satan, if it was indeed him, David didn't know for sure, faded away, and for a while there was only the dark. Tell me what to do, God. Tell me what you want. And if it's your will that we should die here, help me not to waste time being mad or being scared or yelling for an explanation. Distant, the howl of a coyote. Then, nothing. He waited, trying to stay open, and still there was nothing. At last he gave up and spoke the prayer-ending words that Reverend Martin had taught him, muttering them into his clasped hands. Lord, make me useful to myself and help me to remember that until I am, I can't be useful to others. Help me to remember that you are my creator. I am what you made, sometimes the thumb on your hand, sometimes the tongue in your mouth. Make me a vessel which is whole to your service. Thanks. Amen. He opened his eyes. As always, he first stared into the blackness in the center of his clasped hands, and as always, the first thing it reminded him of was an eye, a hole like an eye. Whose, though? God's? The devil's? Perhaps just his own? He stood up, turned slowly around, looked at his parents. They were looking back at him, Ellie amazed, Ralph grave. Well, thank heaven, his mother said. She gave him a chance to reply, and when he didn't, she asked, Were you praying? You were down on your knees almost half an hour. I thought you must have gone to sleep. Were you praying? Yes. Do you do it all the time, or is this a special case? I do it 3 times a day, in the morning, at night, and once somewhere in the middle. The middle one I use to say thanks for all the good things in my life and ask for help with the stuff I don't understand. He laughed, a small, nervous sound. There's always plenty of that. Is this a recent development, or have you been doing it since you started going to that church?
She was still looking at him with a perplexity that made David feel self-conscious. Part of it was the black eye. She was developing a hell of a shiner from where the cop had hit her. But that wasn't all of it, or even most of it. She was looking at him as if she had never seen him before. "He's been doing it since Brian's accident," Ralph said. He touched the swollen place over his left eye, winced, and dropped his hand again. He stared at David through two sets of bars, looking as self-conscious as David felt. "I came upstairs to kiss you goodnight this one time. It was a few days after they let Brian go home. And I saw you down on your knees at the foot of your bed. At first I thought you might be, well, I don't know, doing something else. Then I heard some of what you were saying and understood." David smiled, feeling a blush heat his cheeks. That was pretty absurd under the circumstances, but there it was. "I do it in my head now. I don't even move my lips. A couple of kids heard me mumbling to myself one day in study hall and thought I was going feeble." "Maybe your father understands, but I don't," Ellen said. "I talked to God," he said. This was embarrassing, but maybe if it was said once and right out straight, it wouldn't have to be said again. "That's what praying is, talking to God. At first it feels like talking to yourself, but then it changes." "Is that something you know for yourself, David, or is it something your new Sunday pal told you?"
"Something I know for myself."
"And does God answer?"
"Sometimes I think I hear him," David said. He reached into his pocket and touched the shotgun shell with the tips of his fingers. "And once, I know I did. I asked him to let Brian be all right. After Dad took me to the hospital, I went to the Bear Street woods and climbed to the platform me and Bri made in the tree there and asked God to let him be all right. I said that if he did that, I'd kind of give him an IOU. Do you know what I mean?"
"Yes, David, I know what an IOU is. And has he collected on it? This God of yours?"
"Not yet. But when I got up to climb back down the tree, God told me to put my excused early pass on a nail that was sticking out of the bark up there. It was like he wanted me to turn it in, only to him instead of Mrs. Hardy in the office. And something else, he wanted me to find out as much as I could about him. What he is, what he wants, what he does, and what he won't do. I didn't exactly hear that in words, but I heard the name of the man he wanted me to go to, Reverend Martin. That's why I go to the Methodist Church. I don't think the brand name matters much to God, though. He just said to do church for my heart and spirit, and Reverend Martin for my mind. I didn't even know who Reverend Martin was at first."
"But you did," Ellie Carver said. She spoke in the soft, soothing voice of a person who suddenly understands that the person she's talking with is having mental problems. "Jean Martin has come to the house 2 or 3 years in a row to collect for African Relief."
"Really? I didn't see him. I guess I must have been in school when he came."
"Nonsense," his mother said, now in tones of absolute finality. "He would have come near Christmas, so you wouldn't have been in school. Now listen to me, David, very carefully. When the stuff with Brian happened, you must have, well, I don't know, thought you needed outside help. And your subconscious dredged up the only name it knew. The God you heard in your moment of bereavement was your subconscious mind, looking for answers." She turned to Ralph and spread her hands. "The obsessive Bible reading was bad enough, but this, why didn't you tell me about this praying business?"
"Because it looked private." He shrugged, not meeting her eyes. "And it wasn't hurting anybody."
"Oh, no. Praying is great. Without it, the thumbscrews and the Iron Maiden probably never would have been invented." This was a voice David had heard before, a nervous, hectoring voice that his mother adopted when she was trying to keep from breaking down completely. It was the way she'd spoken to him and his dad when Brian had been in the hospital. She had gone on in that vein for a week or so, even after Brian came around. David's father turned away from her, stuffing his hands in his pockets and looking nervously down at the floor. That seemed to make her more furious than ever. She swung back to David, mouth working, eyes shiny with new tears. "What kind of deal did he make with you, this wonderful God?
Was it like one of the baseball card trades you do with your buds? Did he say, hey, I'll trade you this neat Brian Ross, 84, for this Kirstie Carver, 88? Was it like that, or more like,
lady, he's your boy, and I don't mean to interfere, but why don't you give it a rest? I guess you lost your little girl. I lost my husband. We've all had a tough day.
It was the woman who had shot at the cop. She was sitting on the end of the bunk. Her black hair hung against her cheeks like limp wings, but did not obscure her face. She looked shocked and stricken and tired. Most of all, tired. David couldn't remember ever having seen such a weary pair of eyes. He thought for a moment that his mother would turn her rage on the dark-haired woman. It wouldn't have surprised him. She sometimes went nuclear with total strangers. He remembered once, when he had been about 6, she'd flamed a political candidate trolling for votes outside their neighborhood supermarket. The guy had made the tactical mistake of trying to hand her a leaflet when she had an armload of groceries and was late for an appointment. She had turned on him like some small, biting animal, asking him who he thought he was, what he thought he stood for, what his position was on the trade deficit. Had he ever smoked pot? Had he ever in his life converted the 6-10 split? Did he support a woman's right to choose? On that last one, the guy had been emphatic. He did support a woman's right to choose, he told Ellen Carver proudly. Good. Great. Because I choose right now to tell you to get the holy hell out of my face, she had screamed. And that was when the guy had simply turned tail and fled. David hadn't blamed him either. But something in the dark-haired woman's face. Mary, he thought. Her name is Mary. Changed his mother's mind if blowing up had indeed been on it. She focused on David again instead. So, any word from the big G on how we're supposed to get out of this? You were on your knees long enough. There must have been some sort of message. Ralph turned back to her. Quit riding him, he growled. Just quit it. Do you think you're the only one who's hurting? She gave him a look which was perilously close to contempt. Well? No. No message. Someone's coming, Mary said sharply. There was a window behind her bunk. She stood on the bunk and tried to look out. Shit! Bars and frosted glass with goddamn chicken wire in it. But I hear it. I do. David heard it, too. An approaching motor. Suddenly it revved up, blatting at full power. The sound was accompanied by a scream of tires. He looked around at the old man. The old man shrugged and raised his hands, palms up. David heard what might have been a yell of pain, and then another scream. Human this time. It would be better to think it had been a scream of wind caught in a gutter or a downspout. But he thought it had almost certainly been human. What the hell? Ralph said. Jesus! Someone's screaming his head off. Is it the cop, do you think? God, I hope so! Mary cried fiercely, still standing on the bunk and peering at the useless window. I hope someone's pulling the son of a bitch's lungs right out of his chest! She looked around at them. Her eyes were still tired, but now they looked wild as well. It could be help. Have you thought of that? It could be help. The engine, not too close, but by no means distant, revved. The tires screamed again, screamed the way they did in the movies and on TV, but hardly ever in real life. Then there was a crunching sound. Wood, metal, maybe both. A brief honk, as if someone had inadvertently struck the car's horn. A coyote howl rose, wavering and glassy. It was joined by another, and another, and another. They seemed to be mocking the dark-haired woman's idea of help. Now the motor was approaching, rumbling at a sedate level just above an idle. The man with the white hair was sitting at the foot of the cell's bunk, his hands pressed together finger to finger between his thighs. He talked without raising his eyes from his hands. Don't get your hopes up. His voice sounded as cracked and dusty as the salt flats west and north of here. Ain't nobody but him.
I recognized the sound of the motor.
I refuse to believe that, Ellie Carver said flatly.
Refuse all you want, the old man said. It don't matter. I was on the committee that approved the money for a new town cruiser, just before I finished my term and retired from politics.